Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. In the third hour of our program today, Naomi Klein will be joining us, along and Larry Scott from VAWatchdog.org. We're going to ask Naomi Klein about her thoughts on whether what we're seeing right now is it the vultures moving in on, you know, a disaster, or is it a set-up economic shock? In our second hour, Terry Jeffrey will drop by from CNSNews.com. We've had a secret mic planted over at the McCain campaign where they're practicing for the debates today. Here's a little clip.
I'm an old man. I hate everything but Matlock. Ooh, it's on now.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Off he goes. And there's a new ad out from the Obama campaign I want to share with you. Bob Petraeus has a piece. This is fascinating. GOP attacks on American voters turn desperate, ugly, and dangerous. And the interbank lending seems to have been continuing to be frozen. An interesting piece in today's Financial Times. And Bloomberg reporting that Henry Paulson is reporting that because of the way we're putting money into our banks, we will have absolutely no say, no oversight, no nothing. We just give them the cash and hope for the best. In the midst of all this, strange stuff going on in Wall Street. And Mark Mitchell wrote what I thought was an absolutely brilliant piece. He writes this thing called the Mitchell Report for DeepCapture.com. DeepCapture.com, the website. He's a former editorial page reporter based in Europe for the Wall Street Journal. And as I said, currently authors the Mitchell Report. And, Mark, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much for having me.
You wrote this piece about naked short selling, and I just wanted to share it with my listeners and have you do it in your words. I thought you did it so well. How is naked short selling responsible for Wall Street's woes? Who should be prosecuted for it? Should we be? And for that matter, let's just lay out, you know, once and for all what naked short selling is, and that it has nothing to do with something that we should probably, you know, cover our eyes, or maybe we should. I don't know.
Right. Well, I mean, believe it or not, and it's hard to believe, but hedge funds and brokers are allowed to sell stock that they don't have. And they sort of give an IOU. And in effect, they're selling phantom stock.
Right.
That dilutes supply and causes prices to crash. And there's a good deal of evidence that they targeted a lot of the big banks that went down over the last couple of months. And they did this by selling something they don't have. And so only on Wall Street can you get away with that.
Now, the law or the rules require them, correct me if I'm wrong on this, require them to at least have contracted to acquire that stock in the event, in other words, to be able to cover their short sale in the event that they actually have to deliver the stock. Is that not right?
Well, the new rules are that they have to locate the stock before they sell it. But it's left pretty vague what that means. What does it mean to locate? And the way Wall Street works is you have a short-selling hedge fund calls up its broker and says, sell the stock. The broker says, I don't have the stock. Have you located it? And the hedge fund says, oh, yeah, I located it. It's
on the New York Stock Exchange
or something. So just sell. Push the button.
Yeah. So, you were talking about as many, for example, and you say, in other words, hedge funds and brokers sold as many as 9 million shares that they did not possess, which is why they had, they, quote, failed to deliver, quote, them, end quote, them, and kept the market saturated with at least a million phantom shares for more than 2 weeks to drive down WaMu and Washington Mutual. 9 million short shares. Are you suggesting, Mark Mitchell, that the collapse of a number of these banks, particularly WaMu, but you're looking at Bank of America, Fannie Mae, MBIA, AmBac, and close to 50 smaller financial firms, not to mention a couple hundred non-financial companies, that these failures to deliver, and I guess we should define that term too, that these aren't people who are looking at the market going down or looking at market fundamentals or structurally unsound companies or companies that are holding bad debt and saying, hey, I think I'll bet against this company. I remember back in the 70s walking into a stockbroker in the late 70s, when the market went south, walking into a stockbroker's place and saying, I think the market's going to go to hell. I want to buy some puts on General Motors. And I lost all my money, because it didn't go as far south as I thought it would. And it was my one and only experience doing that. But this is not that. Are you suggesting that this is actually markets being manipulated by people?
It's absolutely markets being manipulated by people. I mean, some of these companies do have problems, and they tend to go after companies that have some kind of problem that can be amplified. And that's why they call it short and distort. They basically blow all the problems completely out of proportion. At the same time, engaging in this naked short selling, which involves selling stock that they don't have, and failing to deliver it by the due date.
So what is a failure to deliver?
If you sell a stock short, then you have 3 days to deliver. If it hasn't been delivered to the person who bought it within 3 days, then it's called a failure to deliver.
So the sale gets registered as a sale and thus affects the price of the stock, because everybody's looking at, holy cow, look at how many of those shares of that stock have been sold. But it's not really a sale because you're not actually delivering the stock because you failed to deliver the stock, right?
They're pushing a button that says that they sold the stock. And if you look on your computer, it'll say that you received that stock that you bought. Mm-hmm. But in fact, the stock does not exist until the day that it registers as a delivered stock.
Right.
And during that period when it hasn't been delivered, it is in effect phantom stock.
You wrote, the attack on Bear Stearns, for example, began on January 9 when hedge funds naked shorted more than 1.1 million shares. The shares failed to deliver at the end of Friday, January 11, the three-day deadline. For the next 4 days, beginning Monday, January 14, there were massive failures to deliver, peaking at 1 million shares on January 17. That is, the attack lasted a total of 8 days, with failures to deliver lasting precisely 5 days. On day six, there were few failures to deliver, so Bear did not appear on the threshold list. In other words, if somebody fails to deliver within the 3 days, then the thing kind of goes into space, but if they fail to deliver beyond 6 days, then it gets flagged, right?
If failures to deliver continue for 5 days in a row, right?
For 5 days. Some failures can
settle, some don't, but if the total quantity of stock that has not been delivered.
Right. So what these guys are doing is they're betting that within 5 days they can kill the stock value of a company. They can drive it down to the point where if they have to cover those shorts, they can do it profitably.
That's right. That's right. And I think that's what they were doing with the big banks. And some of the smaller companies, you see, they have stock that just never gets delivered. It goes undelivered for weeks and months at a time. But the bigger companies, they seem to be doing it in sort of five to eight day waves.
And this is to avoid regulatory, not oversight. It's not even oversight, but notice, regulatory notice, perhaps.
Right.
And if, just using the Bear Stearns example, 1.1 million naked shorts on one day, and doing this day after day, I mean, if Bear's stock was trading, say, around $30 at that time, a million shares, that's $30 million. Somebody is asserting that they're buying every single day. This is not something that you or I could do with an E-Trade account.
No, we can't do it, unfortunately. We don't have that privilege of the if only the individual investors could get easy money the way some people on Wall Street.
So is this a small group of are these only brokers who can do that? I mean, who's doing this?
It's hedge funds that are doing it, and they're doing it with brokers who are willing to help them do it.
Are complicit.
And only the SEC can say for sure who's doing it, and the data is contained in an organization, a sort of black box organization on Wall Street called the Depository Trust and Clearing Corporation.
We have about a half a minute left here, Mark. Is anybody looking into this?
Well, the SEC says it's looking into it, but so far no evidence that they're actually going to do anything about it.
Is that because of this religion of hands off the marketplace?
It's partly that, and it's partly that the short sellers have been helping the SEC do investigations of public companies for many years, and the SEC investigators all end up working for hedge funds and their lawyers after they leave.
This is like the defense contractors, the generals who become defense contractors who then sell things to generals.
Very similar, yeah.
Incredible. Mark Mitchell, The Mitchell Report. You can read it over at deepcapture.com. Mark, thanks for coming by and sharing your thoughts with us.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Minutes past the hour. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone. Barack Obama has a new ad out. He's addressing Bill Ayers head on. Just taking this thing on. And, a fine thing it is. Here's the ad.
Bill Ayers is a professor of education who once served with Obama on a school reform board, a board funded by conservative Republicans tied to McCain. When Ayers committed crimes in the 60s, Obama was 8 years old. Obama condemned those despicable acts. Ayers has had no role in Obama's campaign and will have no role in his administration. Obama says this campaign should be about how to fix our economy, help small businesses and homeowners on Main Street, and crack down on Wall Street abuses. And John McCain, with no plan to fix our economy, smears are all he has left.
There you go. Great ad. Great ad. Well done. I mean, it's pushing back just makes perfect sense. And in the meantime, we have an economy that is melting down. We got Thomas Friedman today. He's op-ed in the New York Times. He says, our financial bubble has many complex strands feeding into it. We got away from the basics, from the fundamentals of prudent lending and borrowing. Thomas. No. Yes, of course that happened, but our disaster here is the result of your book, The Olive Tree and the Lexus. Our disaster here is the result of the ideology that you and your friends, your other billionaire friends, have been promoting for 2.5 decades now, that we should just all wear the golden straitjacket and throw wide the doors so that American workers are competing with people in China making 30 cents an hour, and isn't that a fine thing? It's this flat world philosophy that has forced the American worker, in order to simply stand still, to maintain a decent lifestyle, to go from taking their paycheck and spending that every month for their house, their car, they're putting their kids through school, food, clothes, whatnot, to borrowing money against the value of their home and leasing cars instead of buying them. It used to be, 30 years ago, you looked at America and you looked at cars and you looked at houses and you saw a lot of equity. Most people owned at least half of their car and a good chunk of their house. Now you look at houses and cars, it's no longer an ownership society. You're seeing people who are chained to their leases and their mortgages. They got nothing. They got nothing. And in the midst of this, here, this from USA Today, Liz Szabo writing, more cancer patients are now struggling to pay for their medicines. 1 in 8 people with advanced cancer turned down recommended care because of the cost. Among patients with incomes under $40,000, 1 in 4 refused treatment. This is the result of 26 years of insane conservative economics. There's just no other way to put it. And now Bush comes along and he says, "Oh, we're gonna bail out the banks. Isn't that a fine thing? We're gonna give them $325 billion." But unlike England, where when they bought Northern Rock, they bought the majority of it. They bought a majority of the shares, the largest and one of the oldest banks in the UK, and they bought it and said, you know, okay, we're going to fire the senior management. We're going to take control of payroll. We're going to send in the guys with the green eye shades, and we're going to run this thing like it should be run. No, that's not how we're doing it in the United States. Instead, we're giving $125 billion out of this $325 billion so far to 9 major U.S. banks. And this, as Bloomberg pointed out, Bloomberg News, the equity stakes the government is purchasing in Citigroup, Inc., Morgan Stanley, and 7 other big institutions come with no guarantee that the investments will spur lending and unfreeze credit markets. Nor do they give the government board seats or any other leverage to demand that the firms actually use the money to help the economy. Charles Horn, former official at the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, part of the Treasury Department, and now a partner in the firm Mayer Brown, law firm in Washington, D.C., says, the truth of the matter is, they can't put a gun to their head and say, you have to lend this money. No, they can't, because we're not buying majority shares in these companies. We are not nationalizing these companies. We're simply giving them money that is being borrowed in your name and mine from the Chinese and the Saudis, and is going to have to be paid back with interest, and the banks aren't even going to pay the damn interest on it. You and I are. And meanwhile, front page of today's Financial Times, headline, bailout fails to free up interbank borrowing. The costs for banks to borrow money from each other remain at highly elevated levels in spite of the global government action taken to curb the paralysis at the heart of the financial system. I'm telling you, I've been saying it all along. I've been saying it from day one. They are trying to buy 3 more weeks, 20 days. They just want to get us to November 4th. So that the Republicans can have some semblance of control. They're trying to hold on to 60 seats in the Senate. They're trying to hold on to the White House. It's all about 20 days. Because the steps that this administration, this is the Bush administration, keep in mind. Henry Paulson works for George W. Bush. The steps that the Bush administration is taking are not structural. They are not going to fix this problem. In fact, they are going to make it much worse because the next president will inherit an additional $700 billion that he can't spend because Bushies, these guys have taken the China and the silver on their way out.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Nobody knows where the rivers flow, and I call it home, and there's no more lies in the darkness is light, and nobody cries, there's only butterflies. Take me away.
Helping you win the water cooler wars. Tom Hartman here with you, 34 minutes past the hour. Yeah, maybe we're all totally crazy. Okay, Merrill Lynch, Bank of New York Mellon, Citigroup, Goldman Sachs. Gee, what a surprise there. I'm shocked. Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan Chase, Morgan Stanley, State Street, and Wells Fargo taking $125 billion of our dollars that we're borrowing from the Chinese, that we're going to pay back to the Chinese. And George W. Bush says, and I quote, These measures are not intended to take over the free market, but to preserve it. Well, I suppose you could argue that in a strange sort of way, that's the case. We are leaving these companies completely independent. They can tell us to take a leap. They can tell us that they're going to pay their CEOs whatever they damn well please. They can lay off people. They can move their operations over. They can do anything they want with our money because we have no control over them. But we gave them $125 billion. This is crazy. Downright, I mean, you know, usually our crazy alerts are for things that are, like, you know, really strange. Well, this is really strange. I don't know how to say it beyond that. It's just totally, totally strange. Dan in Boston, Massachusetts. Hey, Dan, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. You know, I'm not totally naive, but I just can't wrap my hands around, my mind around the problem that we have in this country. Naked short selling, selling stocks you don't have, siphoning every red cent out of the system, and then having the balls to go after government for a loan. I just can't understand it. What can we do short of finding out where these people live? What can we do? I'll take your answer off here. Thanks, Tom.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you very much for the call. It's, you know, frankly, I think the only thing that we can do is vote the ideology out. We need to wake up from the ideology that says, as Alan Greenspan, you know, promoted this idea, and this is a widely held belief. Right. I mean, this is a very, very widely held belief that the markets will always correct. They will always do the right thing. They're always going to be in our interest. They're, you know, it's just plain old, flat out wrong. And this whole idea that, well, the marketplace will take care of itself and it will always, I mean, William Seidman, I was mispronouncing his name last week. He was talking about this last week in Grand Rapids. And this is the guy who was the head of the Resolution Trust Corporation that took the savings and loan industry out of bankruptcy. He was the former chairman of the FDIC. He's a very, very smart guy, a brilliant economist, and a lifelong Republican. And here's what he had to say about this.
It was proposed that their regulation, or at least disclosure, be required.
Now, he's talking about derivatives, the derivatives market.
And the industry fought it. And the Federal Reserve, under Alan Greenspan, vehemently opposed.
Now, keep in mind, there's $55 trillion worth of derivatives. The GDP of the planet is $62 trillion. There's $55 trillion of derivatives just in the United States.
And they made the argument, which you hear all the time, and I can remember Alan and saying, look, these are sophisticated contracts between knowledgeable buyers and knowledgeable sellers. No regulator can do as well as they'll do. So what do you need a regulator for? The market will regulate these. And he won the day.
Greenspan.
So among the list of our friends, along with me and others, Alan was clearly, I'd say, the key person responsible for the fact that we didn't even know how many of those contracts there were, and they were up in the trillions. So when AIG got in trouble, it turned out that they had one division with 400 people in it. They had 80,000 employees. They had 400 people in one division. They wrote all these contracts. They didn't report any of them. So they were, you'd say, gambling by writing these contracts. And when things started to go bad and they had to pay on these contracts, the whole monster, the largest insurance company in the world, went under.
There you go. Bill Seidman, just, you know, laying it out. It's the ideology, depending on where you're from. Washington Post today, Harold Meyerson writing an op-ed called Gods That Failed. This is the death. And thank God, literally, this is what we are hopefully seeing here, is the death of this right-wing, world is flat, throw open the doors, throw open the barriers, let the so-called free market control everything, let the transnational corporations make the laws for the United States, because after all, we did join the WTO, right? And so they get to make our laws, and let the big corporations in Canada and Mexico and the United States make the laws with regard to NAFTA, and let's, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Hopefully, we are seeing the death of this insanity, because for 26 years it has been raping this country. It has stripped us of our assets. It has destroyed our ability to function as a decent and functional economy that builds and supports a strong middle class. And I know the corporate media is doing everything they can to not talk about this stuff, because the corporate media is part of the problem by and large. These are the same large transnational corporations. Jack Welch, the chairman who was the chairman of and CEO of General Electric, and wrote all of, you know, wrote that great biography that Tom Brokaw and Tim Russert lovingly interviewed him about. And Jack Welch is the guy who brags in his autobiography about going over to India back 15, 20 years ago and looking around and saying, you know, the people here speak English and they're willing to work for a buck an hour. Why do I have anybody doing bookkeeping for General Electric back in the United States where I've got to pay people $30 an hour? And he started outsourcing back office operations to India and essentially invented that industry. And he brags about it in his autobiography. And we're supposed to say, oh, yeah, these guys are the captains of industry. They're geniuses. Why? Because they're worth hundreds of millions of dollars. They must be geniuses. No, they're thieves. Dave in Los Angeles. Hey, Dave.
Hey, Tom. On that naked shorting issue,
yeah.
I mean, this thing is a huge problem. And there's a little bit of irony to this, though. It started mainly when Harvey Pitt took over, you know, way back when.
As head of the SEC.
Exactly. And they were going after the NASDAQ companies.
Now, hang on just a second. Harvey Pitt was, what year was that? What presidency?
That was under Bush.
That was under Bush Jr. or Bush Sr.?
Bush Sr.
Yeah, Bush Sr. Okay.
I mean, I'm sorry. Bush Jr.
Bush Jr., okay.
Put Harvey Pitt in there.
Okay.
And he was another one of these ones that was on the other side of regulation,
mm-hmm.
put in charge of regulating the stock market. But what's going on with this, it had started with the NASDAQ and the smaller companies. And it was going to particularly the Internet companies at the time. The Internet was diving. Nobody questioned anything. And it's grown to the point now where they're going after the actual firms that enabled it, and some of the firms that were doing it themselves, like Goldman Sachs, Bear Stearns,
yeah.
their trading desks were doing it too. Yeah. And it's kind of grown into this monster. But I wanted to say
it's still unregulated.
It's a very complex issue. There is a website put together by Patrick Byrne, who was the CEO of Overstock, who fought this thing. And it's called businessjive.com. And it's an hour and a half presentation. It takes a commitment, but it explains it. It's very, very complex.
Mm-hmm.
But it affects everyone on Main Street. It affects jobs. It affects technologies. It kills off companies.
Yeah.
Just in this presentation, you'll see the mechanics. And what they do is they, right now in the media, they try to confuse you. Even the SEC with Christopher Cox is trying to confuse legal shorting with naked shorting.
Right. No, I know. And it has done so well that on this show, whenever I talk about naked shorting, I get emails from people going, hey, I'm a short seller. I've been playing the market here. I've got an E-Trade account. Are you accusing me of doing something illegal? And I'm saying, no. You know, the short selling, of course, is hedging your bets if you're actually borrowing the stock and you're going to deliver it. But
exactly.
But when you've got a million failures to deliver in one day on one company, you tell me that there's not something going on?
This problem, and by the way, this problem alone, just this problem alone, regardless of everything else,
mm-hmm.
could collapse the world economy if they were forced to cover this. The problem is because these counterfeit shares are out there.
Yeah,
they don't exist. If the shorts were forced to cover, they would have to buy back shares that don't exist. The supply and demand curves never meet.
Well, on the other hand, I mean, you flip that around. If they were forced to cover these shares all of a sudden and I mean, literally were like threatened with prison, and so they had to go out and buy the stock, you could see the stock market go up 3,000 points in an hour and a half.
Well, yes, it would go up fantastically on these on the ones that are shorted. In fact, that's happened just on the threats from the SEC when they were talking about it recently. We've had pops in stocks. There's a list
right.
out there that are
making. Yeah, you saw Goldman pop up, for example.
Yeah, exactly.
Although I was wondering, okay, is this people, you know, bailing from short selling the company, or is this because they know that they're going to get part of that $125 billion, no strings attached, and the CEO can continue to pay himself millions of dollars and et cetera, et cetera.
It was a short squeeze. It's what they call a short squeeze.
Yeah, okay, makes sense. Dave, thanks a lot for the call. Yeah, and once again, that website was?
BusinessJive.com.
BusinessJive, like J-I-V-E.
Correct.
.com. Great. Dave, thanks a lot. I'll check it out. In fact, I'll check it out during the break. 45 minutes past the hour. And Harold Meyerson's piece in today's Washington Post, Gods That Fail, is very interesting. Very interesting to read. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at HartmanRadio.com.
Program brought to you in part by the Teamsters, proud supporters of the Employee Free Choice Act. Go to .org for more information. Teamster.org. And by the way, Friday night of this week, I'll be giving a speech and doing a book signing for the Democratic Party, Democratic headquarters in the San Fernando Valley, dpsfv.com. If you want to check that out, that'll be in Van Nuys. DPS, as in Democratic Party, SFV, as in San Fernando Valley, .com. And on Sunday, Stephanie Miller and I will be debating a couple of conservatives. I don't have their names here. I'm not sure exactly who it's going to be. I believe it's going to be a couple of Salem radio hosts at the American Jewish University from 2 to 4 p.m. And to register for that, you need to call a phone number. I'll give you that phone number. You can also find it over at TomHartman.com on our homepage. And that phone number is 310-440-1246. It's $25 to show up, and it should be a really interesting afternoon. 310-440-1246. If you live in L.A. and you want to see Stephanie and I debate these guys this weekend, this Sunday, should be a good one. Should be a very good one. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Flo in Sunrise, Florida. Hey, Flo, welcome to the show.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to say something about Harvey Pitt.
Mm-hmm.
That's where my husband lost his retirement.
How 40, so?
43 years, and it just makes me sick. He came on the CBS News and said that Cox was doing a heck of a job. It's something like that Brownie deal.
Mm-hmm.
You're doing a heck of a job.
Yeah.
So remember when Enron went down, with they had the consulting. Anderson did the consulting and the accounting.
Right.
That was part of the problem, too. So he had... So
was Harvey Pitt part of that? I confess, I don't, you know, I remember Harvey Pitt's name. I remember him being there.
Yeah, he was the SEC chairman at
that
time.
Oh, he was at that time.
My husband lost everything to Morgan Stanley. We had mutual funds. We were supposed to be in safe, only a small percentage.
Yeah.
But yet he only had less than a third of his retirement left. They wouldn't take phone calls.
Amazing. I'm looking at this. He was the 26th chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission, serving from 2001
to 2003. He had the nerve to say that Cox was doing an excellent job. But what I called you about was that last night on the Jim Lehrer News Hour,
mm-hmm.
He does a pretty darn good job. He had a replacement last night, but he does a good job of breaking down things. And
yep.
This Robert Glauber, he worked for a Bush administration in the Treasury Department.
Mm-hmm.
He said his concern now is that these small banks can maybe take risky investments. They're going to maybe make risky investments that they can't handle. And he said that's what brought down the savings and loans before.
Yeah.
So
it may well be, Flo. Flo, thanks for sharing your story with us and for the call. This is such a tragedy. And I'm telling you, if you look at the core fundamentals, we don't make stuff in the United States anymore. We did in 1930. We were using 100% of our own oil. In fact, we were the largest exporter of oil in the world in 1930. We're now the world's largest importer. We were wealthy in the 1930s. We had other countries who owed us money. We are now broke. We're the largest debtor in the world right now. So it's going to be a lot harder to pull out of this than it was in 1930. There's some very serious challenges, that the next president is going to face. And these guys are, they're just, I mean, lipstick on a pig is not a metaphor that even begins to address how deep and serious this problem is. We are looking at a very serious recession. And what I would say to my kids if I was sitting around with them, in fact, I was last night, I should have said it, is, you know, if you've got a job, keep it. If you can get a job, find it. If you have debt, pay it off. If, you know, and learn to live frugally. Now is not the time to be splurging, frankly. I mean, we're gonna go through a couple of years here where unemployment is going to be much higher than it is, where money is going to be harder to get, where credit card debt is going to be much more expensive, where home loans are going to be more expensive and harder to get. And, you know, we'll get through it. And in fact, it'll be a healthy thing. You know, the good news is that on the back end of this, we could transform America and the world in very, very positive ways. There's a bright lining to this gray cloud. But we have to get through it, and we have to get through it with our eyes wide open. Not this horse pucky that's being shoveled out by the Bush administration. Oh, we'll give these banks, we'll give Goldman Sachs, we'll give them all $125 billion, and we won't ask for any voting shares, and we won't ask for any seats on their board, and we're not going to take them over. No, we're not socialists like those British. It's amazing. Randall in Kennett Square, Pennsylvania. Hey, Randall, what's on your mind?
Hi there. I own some exchange-traded silver funds, and they were severely depressed recently by short selling, supposedly from two U.S. banks. And it turns out, if the internet can be believed, that you cannot buy silver coins, U.S. Eagles, in some places now.
Right. Yeah. No. I've heard that they're increasingly it's getting difficult to find. So, and for that matter, gold, you know, it's, and I think it was a week ago Monday I shared with you or shared with my listeners the front page story in the Financial Times. It was the right sidebar on the front page, on the top, above the fold of the Financial Times, about how all around the world, companies that were delivering gold were delivering them to the private vaults of the very wealthiest people in the world. This was not, you know, the average person buying gold. These are the super rich, the billionaires, and the multi-billionaires.
Yeah.
And you know, when you see the billionaires, you know, it's getting gold. It's sort of like the old story about it's been attributed variously to Joe Kennedy and others that, you know, when the taxi driver was giving them or the shoeshine boy was giving them stock market advice, they knew it was time to get out of the market. You know, when the billionaires are buying gold, then, you know, it should be a flag that something's going on. Randall, thank you very much for the call. Terry Jeffrey will be with us, the editor-in-chief at CNS News, a conservative website over there. We'll get his take on some of these issues. Let's see if a conservative can defend the so-called free market. It should be interesting. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back to the second hour of our show. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Terry Jeffrey on the line with us, the editor-in-chief of CNSNews.com. Hey, Terry.
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Just great. I don't know if you saw this piece in the Washington Post this morning. It would make a nice bookend with the piece that you wrote, The Price of Banking on Government. It's called Gods That Failed by Harold Meyerson.
I haven't seen it, no. But.
Okay. Well, it's from a 1949 book where a number of famous writers, Andre Gide, Richard Wright, Stephen Spender, wrote a book called The God That Failed, in which all these former communists renounce communism. And he's pointing out that you've got all these backers of free market fundamentalism, of laissez-faire, of let the market regulate itself. You know, the Greenspan, Reagan, Bush doctrine, and Democrat Robert Rubin, for that matter, doctrine, And, let me just share with you the last sentence, and if I can get the page apart here. He says, having spent his career, he's talking about John McCain, he says, having spent his career championing the policies that resulted in this meltdown, McCain now champions policies that will turn recession into a depression. He's entitled to his beliefs, but the nation can't afford to worship at the altar of these failed gods. Your response, sir.
Well, I would say that true free market conservatives never embrace this stuff. Ronald Reagan would not have embraced this stuff. He would not have backed either the policies of Jimmy Carter, Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, or John McCain on this. And, in fact, Dick Armey, who was a Reagan free market guy, is saying that this purchase of equity in the big banks by the federal government ought to be challenged constitutionally. He doesn't think they have the constitutional authority to do this. So,
well, I think it's a waste of money because we're not, you know, unlike the UK buying Northern Rock, where they actually bought a majority share of the bank and then they went in and fired all the fools that ran the thing into the ground and took over ownership of it. We have no control over any of these banks whatsoever. We're simply giving them money. We're not even getting voting shares, much less taking, you know, majority positions or anything like that. So this is not a nationalization. This is simply a, here, have $125 billion that we borrowed from China for you last week.
Well, you know, my worry, Tom, is precisely the argument you're making would prevail in a Democratic administration and a Democratic in Congress when the government is going to still own chunks of these banks. And in fact, there are some restrictions that go along with this. You're right, these aren't voting shares and they're not going to totally run these banks. So they are already telling these banks some of the things they are going to have to do. I think the question is whether what the government tells the banks to do is whether that field of things is going to increase over time.
Yeah, the banks can tell the government to take a hike though, Terry. And you and I both, the banks can tell the government to take a hike, and you and I both know it. I mean,
well, they should have. I agree with you.
No, I don't mean to take their money. I mean, the banks can say to the government, oh, you think we should limit executive compensation? Tough. We're not going to. And there's absolutely nothing the government can do about it.
Well, in terms of the statute there, you may be right on this. I mean, I find this, remarkable. I mean, just the whole thing. The fact that, look, Tom, I do think that there is a basic partnership between Wall Street bankers and big government. And they have interests, people, politicians who are interested in big government and pursuing the perpetuation of their power through big government have always worked in tandem with these massive Wall Street banks and these billionaires who run these Wall Street banks. And the idea that these guys who represent shareholders, there's millions of Americans who hold shares in these banks, and these guys who showed up Monday at the Treasury to meet with Bernanke and Paulson, their job is to represent the interests of those shareholders, which
theoretically.
I do, and they're paid millions of dollars to do it, and I do not believe they did it, but I do believe this is a classic example of big government and big business working together against the interests of free enterprise and the American people.
Well, on that point, you and I agree, but for different reasons. We agree. I would agree with that statement because I think that this is going to be absolutely ineffective. If we look at what happened in 1929, where we had the same kind of liquidity crisis, we had the same kind of freezing up of interbank lending, we had the same kind of massive widespread speculation on Wall Street that was fueled by cheap and easy credit, and a bubble that punctured the burst was the housing bubble. There was a huge inflation in housing from 1921 to 1927. That bubble burst in 27, started bursting really bad in late 28, and it took down the stock market in 29. And Herbert Hoover, over a three-year period, in late 29, in 30, in 31, and in 32, the last one was in August of 1932, Congress passed a $1.6 billion, which would be $1.6 trillion in today's dollars, program that put people back to work, that basically was the FDR New Deal. And Hoover vetoed it, and his veto stood. And so it never happened. So it sounds to me like what you're suggesting is what George W. Bush should have done is exactly what Herbert Hoover did, which is let the whole thing go to hell and as J.P. Morgan back then said, liquidate everything?
Well, I think America basically has two choices here. It's like you probably agree with me that every time the United States goes to war, the power of government increases. And individual liberty is diminished. The scope of the state increases. Now, sometimes
it was James Madison's famous
point. Sometimes it's a necessary evil. It's like in medicine, every drug and every medication you give somebody has negative effects. And the job of a doctor is really to calculate, it's necessary to apply this medication to get the positive effects, because the negative health impact of not curing the person's disease is too great to deal with. Well, there's an analogy with war and economic intervention. And every time you have an economic crisis, you increase the government intervention in the market, and you decrease the potential overall prosperity in the long term of the country.
How is it that with a lot of intervention, I mean, during the Great Depression, Roosevelt created the Securities and Exchange Commission and was yelled at for being a socialist. He created Social Security. He created unemployment insurance. He created all the things, the basic social safety net and the basic infrastructure of regulation, the FDIC, that many people today are saying is one of the reasons why we're not in a full-blown depression right now, that there actually is some fabric underneath us to fall into, not as much as in many other countries. That doesn't seem to me like, you know, a bad thing. It seems to me like a good thing. I mean, isn't this much like nuclear power, Terry Jeffrey, that to say, oh, yeah, nuclear power plants, sure, let's just have them be totally unregulated. Nobody needs to watch over them. And then they start melting down.
I would say this is
a public utility.
I would respond to you this way, Tom. Some regulation in the market is absolutely necessary. They're saying that a moderate and prudential regulation of the market is a good thing. However, that safety net you're talking about is not going to hold. And FDR put in place things, and I will say Social Security is one of them. And he created this idea of an entitlement state where people ultimately were dependent on the government that, you know, people can watch my words. This is going to come back to haunt us in a much greater and more profound way. It will have a much more serious impact on the long-term freedom of the American people than this banking crisis we have now.
Well, if you're defining freedom as the freedom to go bankrupt, the freedom to be homeless, the freedom to live in your car, the freedom for as one in four Americans earning under $50,000 a year with a cancer diagnosis right now, the freedom not to take medical care because you can't afford the copays.
No, but Medicare will in fact bankrupt the country. That's a fact. It will bankrupt the country. And
if we keep doing it the way the Republicans set up with this Medicare drug benefit where they can't negotiate with the pharmaceutical companies, I agree.
Well,
but if we did it rationally, no.
Now, if the Republicans and Democrats sit around and talk about who's going to better micromanage the welfare state, this country is doomed. And you know, people can mark my words. 10, 15 years from now, when the crisis hits over entitlement payments, people will say, how come no one was talking about this? How come no one was warning about this? Well, I'm warning about it, and it's real. We have $53 trillion in unfunded liabilities, most of it in Medicare, good chunk of it in Social Security. This is the welfare state. We can't pay for it any more than we can buy people who can't afford homes their homes. And the easy
we can pay for it just fine, Terry.
All
we have to do is have Bill Gates pay the same amount of the same percentage of his paycheck into Social Security and Medicare that you and I pay of ours.
Tom, how much is Bill Gates worth?
I don't know.
I think it's maybe 40, 50 billion.
But it's not his value. It's his income that I'm talking about.
I'm
talking about anybody who's earning over $100,000 right now. Every single dollar of that over $100,000 is not taxed to pay for Medicare and Social Security.
But here's why that's fabulous, Bill. Hey, Tom, Bill Gates maybe is worth $40, $50 billion. Let's say he's worth $70 billion. If the federal government were to seize all of his wealth, all $70 billion or whatever it is, that would hardly be enough to run the Department of Education for 1 year. There simply isn't enough wealth concentrated in the wealthiest people in this country to take it away and run the kind of government we're running now.
Yeah, well, I respectfully disagree, Terry. You look at the numbers and you can see if you lift the cap on Social Security and Medicare taxes and just do it a flat tax like Steve Forbes loves, the programs become solvent. But I guess we'll have to leave it at that. At CNSNews.com, Terry Jeffrey. Thanks, Terry.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Get work before they're too early. pick more notes than the number of ants on the Tennessee anthill. Yeah, there's 1,352 guitar cases in Nashville.
I am getting flashbacks to my first years in radio as a country western DJ before I then became a rock and roll DJ, before I then became a news reporter for 7 years. Anyway, welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. All those, those many years ago. The Bush administration issued a pair of secret memos to the CIA in 2003 and 2004. This is from Joby Warwick in today's LA Times and Washington Post that explicitly endorsed the agency's use of waterboarding and other interrogation techniques. I would say also known as torture. Documents prompted by worries among intelligence officials about a possible backlash if details of the program became public. Now, there's a CIA says, okay, we'll torture these people, but only if you, George, sign off on it. We want the White House's stamp on this thing because we're not going to put our sorry butts in jail over your desire to torture people. The repeated requests for the paper trail reflected growing worries within the agency, that's the CIA, that the administration might later distance itself from key decisions about the handling of captured al-Qaeda leaders, former intelligence officials said. So here we have the White House explicitly and in writing endorsing illegal torture, violations of U.S. law, violations of international law, violations of the U.N. Charter, violation of treaties that we have with other countries, plain old flat out, not to mention just immoral behavior. And not even to mention the worst part of it, immoral behavior that does not produce the results you want. If you want to get good information, the last thing you want to do is torture people. So here we have these guys who have committed these crimes, and they are absolutely desperate. Desperate. Freak out, screaming, bouncing off the walls, desperate to hang on to power because they are looking at the potential of prosecution if the Democrats take the White House, if Barack Obama takes the White House. And so I'm getting these emails, I've looked into the past of Barack Obama, and, you know, he used to, you know, and fill in the blanks, right? I mean, they're getting so ugly, and they're getting so bad. And on top of that, Bob Fitrakis wrote this article for opednews.com. The headline, GOP attacks on American voters turn desperate, ugly, and dangerous. Republicans have mounted an all-out attack against newly registered voters, but the attacks have also spread to long-established voters as well. And then Bob gives some examples. And Bob's a great guy, by the way. He's a lawyer. He and Harvey Wasserman live in Columbus, as I recall, and he's been on the show a couple times. In fact, Bob and I did a fundraiser, a gig together here in Portland at the Unitarian Church. So he goes on. He says, a Republican sheriff in Greene County, Ohio. This guy's going after 302 voters. The sheriff has decided he's going to go out and arrest people. A Republican sheriff in Greene County, Ohio, has demanded Social Security and other records from 302 local voters whose ballots he apparently wants to negate. In Franklin County, home of Ohio State University, Columbus State College, Capital University, Ohio Dominican University, and Otterbein College, if I'm pronouncing that right, election protection observers are reporting continuing surveillance by Republicans at Veterans Memorial, the site for early voting. The observers have documented Republican operatives taking photographs and writing down license plate numbers of voters. They expect similar criminal charges as in Greene County to be filed in the state capitol. In other words, if you vote, the Republicans are getting your license plate numbers and they're going to charge you with a crime. And you get to prove that you're not guilty. Tell me we haven't slid into the gulag. According to McCoy, the sheriff says, this is Lynn McCoy, Greene County's deputy elections director. According to McCoy, the sheriff says he has no evidence of voter fraud other than phone calls stating fraud was a possibility. But nonetheless, he's out to arrest 302 people so far. In 2004, African-American students from Wright State, Central State, and Wilberforce universities colleges were regularly challenged on their registration credentials and forced to endure waiting in lines to vote for hours. Students at Cedarville, a Christian school, mostly white, made no such reports. U.S. District Court Judge George C. Smith, a Reagan appointee, has approved a GOP lawsuit demanding that the state give county boards of elections great leeway in attacking new voter registration forms. The decision would allow Republican challengers access to data from the Bureau of Motor Vehicles and the Social Security Agency to challenge new voters. New York Times has reported the boards of elections in at least 9 critical states, including Ohio, have violated federal law in conducting purges and have been illegally using Social Security databases as part of those purges. Michigan's election director, Christopher Thomas, said his state had removed about 11,000 voters in August. While the Times estimated the real number to be closer to 33,000, he refuses to make the purged files public. Michigan's Secretary of State, Terry Lynn Land, a longstanding Republican partisan. It's just bizarre. CBS News is actually reporting on GOP attempts to cage registered voters from the rolls in 19 states.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
We can hope. This, just to wrap up Bob Fitrakis' piece, the GOP continues to resist attempts to subpoena Michael Connell, a shady Republican computer operative who programmed the 2000 Bush-Cheney website. Connell was also hired by former Ohio Secretary of State J. Kenneth Blackwell in 2004 to tabulate the Ohio vote count. Under Connell, Ohio's vote totals were shunted to a computer bank in the same basement in Chattanooga, Tennessee, that housed the servers of the RNC. In the early morning hours of the morning after Election Day, vote totals mysteriously began shifting from Kerry to Bush, swinging the 2004 election. Connell's cybersecurity industry colleague, Stephen Spoonamore, who has been on this show and told this story, a Republican and former McCain supporter, has said that Connell may be able to shed light on vote count rigging in the 2008 vote count as well. Attorneys in the King Lincoln Bronzeville civil rights lawsuit have thus far been unable to secure Connell's sworn testimony. Meanwhile, the New York Times front page story, new victim of turmoil may be your salary. The worst slump in worker pay since, dash, you knew this was coming, dash, the Great Depression. Yeah. I mean, just looking at the front page of the New York Times today, retail sales slump by 1.2% as economy downshifts. Well, that's going to be great for jobs. The Dow is down 452 points right now. Bernanke says bailout plan will need time to work. Next victim of turmoil may be your salary. We live in Republican times, my friends. Hopefully, that too shall change. 866-303-2270, your telephone number. Chris in Winter Haven, Florida. Hey, Chris, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Good.
Yeah, I've been listening to your show and others, progressives, and I've been wondering why every time a conservative comes on and talks about the end of Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security bankrupting our country, why you guys don't come back and say, look, we just came out of thin air with trillions of dollars to bail out the Wall Street banks. We're spending $12 billion a month in Iraq, plus another, I think, $6 billion in Afghanistan. If we can pay for those wars, surely we could pay for making Medicare and Social Security solvent.
The only problem with that argument, Chris, is that we can't pay for those wars.
Well,
I mean,
we can't,
right?
We're spending
$300 billion a year right now. $300 billion a year. Consider the entire budget for the HEW, for Health, Education, and Welfare, is $32 billion, as I recall. We're spending $300 billion a year on interest payments on our national debt.
Right, and Tom, on this last budget that the Congress just passed was $600 billion at the end of the year here just a month ago.
Yep.
$400-plus billion of that went into the Defense Department, and now they're asking for another almost $400 billion.
I know. The bottom line is we can't afford the wars, Chris. And by the way, if we simply lifted the cap, as Barack Obama is proposing to do on salaries over $250,000 a year, lift the cap on FICA payments, on Social Security and Medicare payments, we can pay for Social Security and Medicare. Every other country in the world does it, and they're doing it just fine, thank you very much, and their economies are not in the tank. I mean, there's a worldwide banking crisis right now because of the insanity that started in this country with Alan Greenspan spread around the world, but that has nothing to do with the fact that other countries can pay for that. You're right, that our military budget is totally.
I don't disagree with that. What I'm saying is that's why I hope that Obama, you know, gets us out of Iraq and Afghanistan because that is part of the problem. And these
You're absolutely right, Chris. But it's only the beginning of the problem. We have more than 700 military bases around the world. We are paying for military empire, and there's no empire for us to protect. It's absolutely nuts. Chris, I appreciate the call. You very well said. Thank you. David in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Hey, David.
Good afternoon. Hi. I wanted to raise a point that nobody's mentioned, and that was when Ronnie Reagan came in, one of the things he did in his first term was before then you could take credit card interest and you could deduct that on your income tax return.
That's right. Interest used to be a deductible. Yeah.
And then from then on, it set it up so that everybody, you could still deduct your home mortgages. And that was the impetus for all these people now to use their, when they get their do the consolidation and take it out on their, take their credit cards and do it against their house, because now you could still deduct your home mortgages.
Yeah, you're right.
And I think something needs to be brought into the lexicon of this discussion, and that is economic treason.
Yeah. Well, see, you know, you're right, David, but it's still the biggest part of the picture here is that wages have not been keeping up with productivity.
Oh,
wages
yeah.
haven't been keeping up with demand. And when the minimum wage and the average wage do not keep up, then people have to dive into debt. And you're right. You know, it used to be that you could deduct credit card debt, but it used to be that most people didn't have much credit card debt too. And now we've got the average taxpayer in America has $7,000 on credit cards. That's nuts.
Right.
And, you know, it's crazy, particularly when credit cards are slamming now people to 20, 25, 30%. You know, we used to have usury laws in the United States. Nixon rolled back the usury laws. It used to be a felony to charge somebody more than 10% interest.
But,
you know, good point, David, and thank you for calling and making it. Well said. J.D. in Kansas City, Kansas. Hey, J.D.
Hey, Tom. Hey, I just wanted to say something about your program. It's just absolutely just awesome. You're a great American. I wanted to find out whether, you know, the things that you said today and the things that you mentioned yesterday about free trade and all that, I mean, is that really getting out there to the people that can really use that information?
There's a small number of members of Congress who get this stuff, J.D. The problem is you've got, even Democrats have been drinking this Kool-Aid. You know, it's, you know, Robert Rubin has been drinking this Kool-Aid. Lawrence Summers was drinking this Kool-Aid. Bill Clinton was drinking and still is drinking that Kool-Aid. And it's at some point they've got to look around and say, okay, we've devastated the American workforce with this Kool-Aid. Maybe it's not good stuff. You know, and hopefully they'll do it before we all end up the way that Jim Jones's Kool-Aid drinkers did, you know, dead on the ground. But, you know, excellent point. We need to be educating Democrats. Voting is just the beginning. It's not the end. It's just the beginning. Stan, thanks for the call, J.D. Stan in Hollywood, California. Hey, Stan.
Hey, everybody. I just wanted to say, I told the call center that my riddle about the emperor's new clothes being made out of derivatives.
Yeah.
But I just want to point out to you and us listeners that the emperor doesn't live in the United States. It's not Andrea Mitchell's husband. It's not George Bush. Who knows? It may be the CEO of the International Settlement Bank in Geneva, with sitting on $1.4 quadrillion worth of funny money. But I think it's really just an idea, more so than a person. And the international phenomenon has the globalization has gone on, what, since the East India or before Alexander the Great wanting to dominate the world and all that.
Yeah, you can go back a whole bunch of times. I mean, you know, the Dutch trading companies and then the East India Company.
Yeah,
and
the whole idea of domination and then going along and hoodwinking everybody with these derivatives, which is just the latest version of the emperor's clothes, it has got to change, and it doesn't change in Geneva, and it doesn't change in Mr. Greenspan's house. It changes in our minds.
No, you're absolutely right, Stan. You're absolutely right. And it started with Frederick von Hayek, the modern incarnation of it. The old incarnation of it really started with Adam Smith in many ways, but the modern incarnation of it started with Frederick von Hayek and Milton Friedman. And has been carried, a torch has been carried by people like Thomas Friedman and Bill Clinton on the so-called left, and Ronald Reagan and both George Bushes on the so-called right, although George Herbert Walker Bush actually seemed to get it that Reagan was preaching voodoo economics. But he drank the Kool-Aid. I mean, they're all just chugging this stuff down. And we've got to look around and say, you know, this didn't work. It's time to go back to what did work, and what did work was what Franklin Roosevelt did. Keynesian economics actually works. Dan in Pontiac, you got a minute before the break. Dan, what's up?
I wanted to ask you about whether you know about Barack Obama's position on, you know, getting out of Iraq. From what I understand, he is planning on keeping enough troops to protect five different key areas there: the Baghdad airport, the Green Zone, the embassy, the oil refineries, and the 14 permanent military bases. Now, if he keeps that many troops there on a permanent basis, how is that getting out of Iraq?
It wouldn't be. And I think what you're describing is George Bush's plan, not Barack Obama's. But whether that is part of his plan or not, the thing that I think that we can safely say about Obama, if you look at his, you know, 12 years in public office and his work before that, is that he's a pragmatist, is that he's going to look at the situation and make a reasonable and hopefully correct decision. I mean, I'm frankly concerned about the fact that he's saying, let's bring more soldiers into Afghanistan. If we want to win, in quotes, in Afghanistan, what we need to do is bring in the equivalent of the Peace Corps. We need to build 1,000 hospitals and schools, or maybe 10,000. That's how you win in Afghanistan. Not with bombs. Look at, you know, Afghanistan bled the Soviet Union dry. Now it's our turn.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at HartmanRadio.com.
Speaking the truth, the multinational corporations would really rather you didn't know all about. Tom Hartman here with you. 9 minutes before the hour. Oh, is this weird? They keep track in Australia, the most requested funeral tunes. Something's going on in Australia. According to the Daily Telegraph, three of the top 10 songs: Ding Dong the Witch is Dead, another one, Bites the Dust by Queen, and AC/DC's Highway to Hell. Very strange. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, on the line with us with a report from Washington, D.C. Hey, Victoria, what's going on in the world?
Well, as a former Australian resident, I don't know what to say.
You lived in Australia.
I lived in Australia. Yes, I did.
I have spent a lot of time in Australia. I love that country. I have some very, very, very close friends in Australia. And we've got a lot of listeners in Australia also who listen to the podcast of this show. I get a lot of email from Australia. Where did you live?
Perth.
Oh, I've 4 years in a row, Louise and I went to Perth. We have a friend who has a house on the seacoast there, and we would stay with her and her husband, and I've been in the Perth newspaper. I forget the name of it. In fact, I met the
Australian.
Yeah. Is that the one that's published out of Perth?
Yeah.
Okay. And I met the guy who is the representative of the Queen. And in Perth, I don't know if he's based out of there or whatever. That was
one of the most beautiful cities in the world.
It really is. It's just extraordinary, right there on the Indian Ocean. It's just amazing. So, what's going on in Washington D.C.?
Well, the president's not here. He's gone off to Michigan to meet with small business owners. So that should be a cheerful meeting, I should think, as they complain.
Wait a minute. George Bush is meeting small business owners. Oh, man, what I would give to be a fly on that wall.
Oh, I'm telling you. Really? That should be great. So while he's doing that, the vice president's going to George Washington University Hospital because he's having some atrial fibrillation problems.
Yes, I understand the price of oil has gone down.
Yeah, well, yeah, ba-dum bum, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, he's got some problems of his own, so that's going on. So that's our presidential and vice presidential news. But all attention is on Hofstra University for the debate tonight and whether, in a vastly overused word, John McCain can bring about a game changer.
Yeah. I'm curious, are you going to be playing a drinking game tonight? And if so, what are the words that you're looking for?
Well, I think Maverick may be off the table.
I think so, too. Yeah.
I think once Tina Fey did it, they took it off the table. Now, Sarah Palin used it this morning in the speech, but then she said Maverick, then she said Patriot. And I think she meant to say Patriot, and she didn't mean to say Maverick. I think she said it by mistake.
Yeah.
I think middle class is going to be a word that's going to be overused tonight.
Oh, that's, I think you're right. I think you're right. I wonder if I agree will be used.
Yes, I agree might be used by Obama, although I don't know. I think the gloves are more off now. I think it's going to be a little bit more touchy than that.
But what can McCain say?
Judgment is going to be a word that's going to be used tonight.
Judgment, yeah, yeah, absolutely, because that's what they're both trying to push. But, I mean, here's, McCain, the essence of McCain's, the reason why he's been saying people should not vote for Obama is that he was on the board of the Annenberg Foundation with Bill Ayers, they were both put on those boards by Republicans. Annenberg was one of the biggest donors to Republicans. He was Ronald Reagan's head of protocol for the State Department. He was Richard Nixon's U.S. ambassador to the United Kingdom. I mean, I'm just boggled by it. It is so weak.
It is, but how explainable is that by Barack Obama in a soundbite? See, I just don't think that part of it's explainable.
Well, they're doing it right now. This is the new ad that the Obama campaign has come out with to respond to the smears having to do with Ayers.
Bill Ayers is a professor of education who once served with Obama on a school reform board, a board funded by conservative Republicans tied to McCain. When Ayers committed crimes in the 60s, Obama was 8 years old. Obama condemned those despicable acts. Ayers has had no role in Obama's campaign and will have no role in his administration. Obama says this campaign should be about how to fix our economy, help small businesses and homeowners on Main Street, and crack down on Wall Street abuses. And John McCain, with no plan to fix our economy, smears are all he has left.
And that's the new Obama ad.
I think that's a good ad.
Yeah, and I guarantee you he has memorized that phrase. he's going to be ready. I mean, when they raise Bill Ayers, he's going to be ready. And it's just going to take the wind out of McCain's sails. He's got to come up with something new. And, what's it going to be? I don't know.
I mean, that their negative research people have been doing research. Maybe they've got something that they've been doing research on that they're going to bring up that nobody's heard. Maybe he's going to do Jeremiah right. But it is a huge risk.
Yeah. Well, I think that the only thing that they have left, we're hearing from people all over the country that they're getting push-polled. that they're getting calls at 3 o'clock in the morning with Obama ads playing with Obama's voice, but it's 3 o'clock in the morning. It sounds, you know, it sounds like it's the Democratic Party making campaign calls.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. And you know, I've gotten this from three different states now. And people down in Florida, we've got people getting called, being told, don't forget to vote on the 14th. Not the 4th.
Oh, no.
And we've got in Virginia people being called and being told that their absentee ballot is in the mail and not to bother to come in to vote, that they'll get their absentee ballot before November 4th. And so, you know, just wait at home for the ballot to come.
Is anybody telling CNN or Fox or anybody about this? So
a lot of this stuff has been
Acorn?
A lot of this stuff has been reported. It's just it largely gets ignored. The voter suppression efforts that are going on right now are just massive all across the United States to shut down the vote. So, you know, I think that that's the only thing that they're hanging their hat on. And there's some small chance that it'll actually work because it did work for them in 2004. I mean, they stole that election through voter suppression and arguably in 2000 as well. I mean, that's how Florida got as close as it was by knocking 80,000 people off the rolls. So
it could work.
Yeah. So we have to get even more people out. Victoria Jones, TalkRadioNews.com. Thanks, Victoria.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Okay, after the Iraq Civil War, a new law is unveiled that would allow Shell and British Petroleum to claim the country's vast oil reserves. Immediately following 9/11, the Bush administration quietly outsources the war on terror to Halliburton and Blackwater. After a tsunami wipes out the coasts of Southeast Asia, the pristine beaches are auctioned off to tourist resorts. New Orleans residents scattered from Hurricane Katrina discover that their public housing, hospitals, and schools will never be reopened. These are examples from The Shock Doctrine by Naomi Klein, who is with us. Hey, Naomi, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Great to talk with you.
Best-selling, award-winning, internationally, New York Times best-selling, internationally syndicated columnist and author of The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. I'm really curious to get your take on whether this disaster that we happen to be seeing here, and it's interesting that phrase is used as in the subtitle of your book. To what extent this is the result of disaster capitalists trying to create a new disaster, and by the way, if so, why didn't they wait until after the election? Because they seem to be more in bed with the Republicans than the Democrats, or if this is the vultures swooping in on a disaster that was the result of just misplaced ideology.
Well, I don't think the disaster is the result of misplaced ideology. I think the disaster is the result of an orgy of greed on Wall Street. I mean, this has been a very profitable disaster on the way up, and I think that's why it happened. And I don't think it's mysterious. I think we just need to look at the bonuses handed out by the top Wall Street firms last year to see why this bubble was allowed to inflate. And the regulators, like Alan Greenspan and Henry Paulson, have allowed this bubble to inflate. I mean, in the case of Henry Paulson, he was one of the people who benefited directly from this volatile, profitable market when he was CEO of Goldman Sachs. And Alan Greenspan has said that, he saw no reason to regulate the derivatives market. He was he fought off attempts to regulate it, and now his best excuse is that he hadn't anticipated that bankers might be dishonest, which is an utterly implausible excuse from the top regulator.
Well, and on top of that, he says, "Oh, gee, I never anticipated that bankers might be dishonest. I guess we'll have to give them $125 billion and not take majority stocks, equity positions in their companies, so that we and not take voting positions on their boards, and not even take a seat on their boards. We're just going to hope that they spend the money well."
Yeah, they're continuing with the honor system. And so these banks are profiting. They profited on the way up. They're profiting on the way down. I don't think it was all a big plot in the sense of it all being planned, but I also think that it's totally implausible that people didn't see this coming. I think they didn't care because it was so profitable not to see it coming, not to anticipate. And because there was, I think Wall Street was betting on exactly what's happened, which is that the regulators who have been in bed with them all along would say they're too big to fail, and they had every reason to anticipate that. You know, we're the hedge, right? You know, there's this quote from Alan Greenspan saying that he thought that the banks were fully hedged. Well, they weren't hedged, but we're the hedge. We are the parachute.
We the taxpayers. Yeah. And our ability to borrow money from China. William Seidman, who was the former head of the Resolution Trust Corporation that reconsolidated $340 billion worth of SNLs and put them back together, and for Bush Senior when the SNL thing crashed, a Republican, and the guy who, when he was running the Resolution Trust, invented the idea of tranching securitized instruments, debt instruments, or asset instruments, mortgage instruments. He invented that. On Monday of this week, or maybe it was Monday, it was Monday of last week, gave a speech in Grand Rapids in which he talked about Alan Greenspan's role in this. He talked about how in 2004, the derivative market was starting to explode, or in the early 2000s, and it was just going, actually, no, this must have been back when he was running the thing. Anyhow, here, let me just play this clip. It's about a minute. This is William Seidman talking about his relationship with Greenspan and their thoughts on this.
Uh-huh. That their regulation, or at least disclosure, be required. And the industry fought it, and the Federal Reserve, under Alan Greenspan, vehemently opposed. And they made the argument, which you hear all the time, and I can remember Alan and saying, look, these are sophisticated contracts between knowledgeable buyers and knowledgeable sellers. No regulator can do as well as they'll do. So what do you need a regulator for? The market will regulate these. And he won the day. So among the list of our friends, along with me and others, Alan was clearly, I'd say, the key person responsible for the fact that we didn't even know how many of those contracts there were. And they were up in the trillions. So when AIG got in trouble, it turned out that they had one division with 400 people in it. They had 80,000 employees. They had 400 people in one division. They wrote all these contracts. They didn't report any of them. So they were, you'd say, gambling by writing these contracts. And when things started to go bad and they had to pay on these contracts, the whole monster, the largest insurance company in the world, went under.
It's William Seidman. I mean, just laying it out. Alan Greenspan, that's the ideology that I was talking about, that I was talking about, is this belief that there is this thing called the free market, mm-hmm. which in and of itself is a fallacy. We create markets by act of government, and we create the rules for them. It's like saying there's such a thing as a free football game, a football game with no rules, with no boundaries, with no 50-yard line, with no goalposts, with no, what a paradise. No, I don't think so.
Right, and it's the role of government to set the rules of the game, and there's been a complete abdication of that role as the government sees its role since Reagan as really just the enabler of the accumulation of wealth in the name of economic growth and trickle-down economics, and that ideology is in crisis. But I guess the one thing that I'm increasingly hesitant to do is even give these guys the dignity of saying that they're driven by ideology. Alan Greenspan made a lot of people really rich. and they adored him for it.
But he spent 10 years with Ayn Rand. You know, he brought a 6-foot-tall dollar bill wreath to her funeral.
Absolutely, but let me tell you, one of the things that's interesting about his life story, and I have to say one of the things, you know, if there's one good thing that's coming out of this crisis right now, it's that Alan Greenspan's reputation is being tarnished, and he's being recognized for the hack that he is. And we're also hearing, you know, there was a great New York Times investigation the other day questioning Greenspan's legacy and quoting, you know, top lawmakers talking about how he had this mysticism around about him that people just were afraid to question him. Right. And I hope people learn from that experience, because I see some of this repeating with this, you know, deification of Henry Paulson, who's even more conflicts of interest than Alan Greenspan. But you know, Alan Greenspan's life story, you know, he was a Wall Street economist. He really wasn't interested in how economics could serve the greater good. This is his own account, and he tells this story. And you know, he came of age, and you know, he went to school during a time, you know, after the Great Depression, when economics was really imbued with this mission of job creation and righting the wrongs of the system that had just brutalized so many people. Alan Greenspan was entirely disinterested in it. He just wanted to make money, and he got some good jobs on Wall Street, and he was good at it, and he was good at math. And then he discovered Ayn Rand, and then he said that what she taught him was that what he was already doing had this higher moral purpose, right? So that's the way
rationale.
I see the ideology, is that essentially it's a rationale, right? Yeah. The ideology, whether it's Ayn Rand or Milton Friedman, basically what it tells people who are already inclined to look out for number one, that in so doing, you know, in pursuing their narrow self-interest, they are actually benefiting the greatest number of people, and that when they try to act in the public interest, they actually do harm. So I see the ideology less as the driving force and more as, you know, a partner in this enterprise that is really driven by greed.
Yeah, but it's an ideology that has swept the Republican Party. It's swept America. Reagan promoted this, and hopefully this will be the death knell of it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Naomi Klein, her book, the must-read book of the year, of the decade, The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism, naomiklein.org, her website. Naomi, thanks for dropping by today.
Great talking with you, Tom.
Great talking with you, as always. 16 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on Air America.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Taking back the corporate media, taking back the mainstream media, whatever you want to call it, 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, right here, Tom Hartman with you. Larry Scott on the line with us. He's the founder and editor of VAWatchdog.org, keeping an eye on the VA because somebody's got to do it, the American Veterans Online News Magazine.
That's us, Tom.
That's you, Larry, and a fine job you're doing of it, and you know, we really appreciate it. The VA budget was passed on time for only the third time in the past 23 years. Do I have that right?
You have that exactly right. For only the third time in the past 23 years, Congress got off the dime and passed the VA's budget prior to the beginning of the new fiscal year. You know, October 1st was the beginning of the 2009 fiscal year.
So this is what happens when you have Democrats in charge of Congress. They actually pass the VA budget on time.
Well, let me tell you what, there are a lot of people who are thinking that way. What happened in past years, they would have to operate under a continuing resolution, which means they would only be allowed to spend at the previous year's level. Because they actually have a real budget this year, there will be no hiring freezes. They can go ahead with hiring instead of waiting 3, 4, or 6 months to hire people. They can maintain facilities. They can buy new equipment. They can open up more clinics. All of that money is there, guaranteed by Congress, and this is a wonderful thing for veterans that we do have an on-time budget this year. And congratulations to the members of Congress, who, quite frankly, we didn't think were going to get it done, but they did it at the last minute.
That's great. That's great. The VA out of Detroit, do I have this right, that there's a VA OIG, Office of Inspector General investigation going on?
Yeah, this is a very interesting thing. Actually, the Office of Inspector General has been investigating a number of what we call regional offices around the country. These are the offices where veterans from that area will file their disability claim. There have been allegations over the last few years of what we call timeliness issues. In other words, a letter gets mailed in for a claim or perhaps a doctor's statement or something. It doesn't get marked on time. It's not, you know, date and time stamped appropriately. Or it gets set aside. It's not attached to the proper file for adjudication. Or records get lost. And so the OIG has been doing these timeliness inspections. They ended up in New York last week and removed the top four officials from the New York regional office because they found them fudging these timeliness figures, saying they were doing things on time when basically the documents were piling up. They went into Detroit here a few weeks ago and found shredder bins full of documents.
Whoa.
Veterans,
you mean post-shredded documents?
Pre-shredded documents.
Oh, pre-shredded.
Thank
great.
Goodness. Thank yeah. goodness. And they were able to identify veterans' disability claims and other documents critical to the claim process. Now, here's what we don't know. If anything was shredded or how much was shredded, that investigation is still ongoing. But this is a story that we developed here exclusively on VAWatchdog.org from sources inside the VA. Current VA employees and former VA employees helped us piece this together and verify it. What they have found in the Detroit regional office is that people were basically hiding paperwork. Paperwork would come in, it wouldn't get stamped, it would be hidden, it would be put in desk drawers, it would be put in boxes. And in this case, they found them in shredder bins. The question we have to ask is, were vital documents shredded? And of all the people I've spoken to, current and former VA employees, they've all said the same thing. You don't put documents in shredder bins for safekeeping.
Right.
So we're going to see how this investigation turns out. It looks really bad for the situation at the Detroit regional office. And we know similar investigations are going on at other regional offices around the country.
Now, you know, Larry, how a Republican would respond to this. See, I told you so. This is what happens when you let government do things. You should have had Acme Widget Company. You should have outsourced this stuff.
Well, yeah. Well, why don't we do that and see? Here's what happens on outsourcing. Let me tell you, VA Secretary James Peake decided he was going to outsource the new GI Bill benefits that just got passed, you know, Senator right. Jim Webb's new advanced GI Bill that offers more money for a longer period of time.
Right, the one John McCain didn't like.
Right, yeah. Exactly right. The one McCain did not like and then was basically forced to join in on at the last minute because
and claimed credit for.
Right, and then claim credit, which that was really an unusual thing. But he was going to outsource this. He was going to hire a company to take care of all of these payments. This was at the very top of the VA, the AFGE, the VA's union complaint. Almost every major veterans group in the country complained, and members of Congress jumped down the VA's throat. They finally backed off. And they backed off a couple days ago and said, we are not going to outsource this program. We are going to use VA employees to develop new computer programs, to write the checks, to make sure that benefits are paid on time. And I think this is a perfect example of what can happen when you get unions, veterans group, veterans who say this isn't going to work, and members of Congress all working together right. to stop a really bad idea.
Yeah, the bottom line here is that whether it's a private corporation or a bureaucracy, if there's not good oversight, you're going
right.
to have a mess.
That's exactly right, Tom.
I mean, and so, you know, let's have a well-run VA and do it in-house and not have to have somebody skim 10% off the top to pay dividends to shareholders.
That's true.
Larry Scott, VAWatchdog.org, the website. Check it out. Larry, thanks for being with us, and thanks for the update.
Thank you, Tom.
Always great talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour. We'll be picking up your phone calls on the other side of this break. 866-303-2270. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Taking back the corporate media, taking back the mainstream media, whatever you want to call it, 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, right here, Tom Hartman with you. Larry Scott on the line with us. He's the founder and editor of VAWatchdog.org, keeping an eye on the VA because somebody's got to do it, the American Veterans Online News Magazine.
That's us, Tom.
That's you, Larry, and a fine job you're doing of it, and you know, we really appreciate it. The VA budget was passed on time for only the third time in the past 23 years. Do I have that right?
You have that exactly right. For the only the third time in the past 23 years, Congress got off the dime and passed the VA's budget prior to the beginning of the new fiscal year. You know, October 1st was the beginning of the 2009 fiscal year.
So this is what happens when you have Democrats in charge of Congress. They actually pass the VA budget on time.
Well, let me tell you what. There are a lot of people who are thinking that way. What happened in past years, they would have to operate under a continuing resolution, which means they would only be allowed to spend at the previous year's level. Because they actually have a real budget this year, there will be no hiring freezes. They can go ahead with hiring instead of waiting 3, 4, or 6 months to hire people. They can maintain facilities. They can buy new equipment. They can open up more clinics. All of that money is there, guaranteed by Congress. And this is a wonderful thing for veterans that we do have an on-time budget this year. And congratulations to the members of Congress, who, quite frankly, we didn't think were going to get it done, but they did it at the last minute.
That's great. That's great. The VA out of Detroit, do I have this right, that there's a VA OIG, Office of Inspector General, investigation going on?
Yeah, this is a very interesting thing. Actually, the Office of Inspector General has been investigating a number of what we call regional offices around the country. These are the offices where veterans from that area will file their disability claim. There have been allegations over the last few years of what we call timeliness issues. In other words, a letter gets mailed in for a claim or perhaps a doctor's statement or something. It doesn't get marked on time. It's not, you know, date and time stamped appropriately. Or it gets set aside. It's not attached to the proper file for adjudication. Or records get lost. And so the OIG has been doing these timeliness inspections. They ended up in New York last week and removed the top four officials from the New York regional office because they found them fudging these timeliness figures, saying they were doing things on time when basically the documents were piling up. They went into Detroit here a few weeks ago and found shredder bins full of documents.
Whoa.
Veterans.
You mean post-shredded documents?
Pre-shredded documents.
Oh, pre-shredded.
Thank
oh, great.
Goodness. Thank yeah. goodness. And they were able to identify veterans' disability claims and other documents critical to the claim process. Now, here's what we don't know. If anything was shredded or how much was shredded, that investigation is still ongoing. But this is a story that we developed here exclusively on VAWatchdog.org from sources inside the VA. Current VA employees and former VA employees helped us piece this together and verify it. What they have found in the Detroit regional office is that people were basically hiding paperwork. Paperwork would come in, it wouldn't get stamped, it would be hidden, it would be put in desk drawers, it would be put in boxes. And in this case, they found them in shredder bins. The question we have to ask is, were vital documents shredded? And of all the people I've spoken to, current and former VA employees, they've all said the same thing. You don't put documents in shredder bins for safekeeping.
Right.
Right. Yeah. So we're going to see how this investigation turns out. It looks really bad for the situation at the Detroit regional office. And we know similar investigations are going on at other regional offices around the country.
Now, you know, Larry, how a Republican would respond to this. See, I told you so. This is what happens when you let government do things. You should have had Acme Widget Company. You should have outsourced this stuff.
Well, yeah. Well, why don't we do that and see? Here's what happens on outsourcing. Let me tell you, VA Secretary James Peake decided he was going to outsource the new GI Bill benefits that just got passed. You know, Senator right. Jim Webb's new advanced GI Bill that offers more money for a longer period of time.
Right, the one John McCain didn't like.
Right, yeah. Exactly right. The one McCain did not like and then was basically forced to join in on at the last minute because
and claimed credit for.
Right, and then claim credit, which that was really an unusual thing. But he was going to outsource this. He was going to hire a company to take care of all of these payments. This was at the very top of the VA, the AFGE, the VA's union complaint. Almost every major veterans group in the country complained, and members of Congress jumped down the VA's throat. They finally backed off. And they backed off a couple days ago and said, we are not going to outsource this program. We are going to use VA employees to develop new computer programs, to write the checks, to make sure that benefits are paid on time. And I think this is a perfect example of what can happen when you get unions, veterans group, veterans who say this isn't going to work, and members of Congress all working together right. to stop a really bad idea.
Yeah, the bottom line here is that whether it's a private corporation or a bureaucracy, if there's not good oversight, you're going
right.
to have a mess.
That's exactly right, Tom.
I mean, and so, you know, let's have a well-run VA and do it in-house and not have to have somebody skim 10% off the top to pay dividends to shareholders.
That's true.
Larry Scott, VAWatchdog.org, the website. Check it out. Larry, thanks for being with us, and thanks for the update.
Thank you, Tom.
Always great talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour. We'll be picking up your phone calls on the other side of this break, 866-303-2270. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
The hour. Tom Hartman here with you, 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Kim in San Francisco, listening on Green 960. Hey, Kim, what's up?
Hey, Tom, you know, I'm never going to question again the intelligence and wisdom of the common man. When the main thing that happened with this whole financial meltdown, in my humble opinion, is that there was a group of academics, well-educated, and we felt intimidated as just common people from insisting on a clear explanation of what they were doing with our money. And I just think it doesn't take a Rhodes Scholar to tell you not to buy something you don't understand. And we all did. We were partly to blame for it, for not demanding a clear explanation. But we were, once again, there was so much media out there about this wonderful new horizon this whole financial industry had us seduced, and we were too intimidated to say, I don't buy this unless I completely understand it. And that was our government's job to help us. So I have to say at this point that when we come to our conclusions about how we're going to fix this, and it's not going to be easy for anybody, we need to insist that they simplify and clarify. I don't want any disclosures sent to me in the mail that I don't understand, that are all in legalese, and that one word you know, whether it be shall or will, in one word of these disclosures can change everything.
No, it's absolutely true. And if you've ever tried to read a mortgage document, I've read several in my life. They can be really intimidating things, or a credit card agreement for that matter.
It's absurd.
But the bottom line here, Kim, let's not lose sight of the fact, the big picture issue here, which is the fact that Americans 30 years ago, before Reagan, by, you know, more than half of the American workforce could raise a family on a single income. America
right.
was a fairly wealthy nation. There was lots of opportunity out there. My wife put herself through college working as a waitress in a Howard Johnson's, and I put myself through college to the extent that I did, working as a DJ making $2.63 an hour, as I recalled. I maybe $2.65. I mean, it was basic minimum wage. You could do that then. Ronald
yeah.
Reagan did away with free education in California. All across the country, everybody bought into this stuff. He started taking apart unions. We're seeing the destruction of the middle class. Why? Because there's these ideologues who think that the middle class is a dangerous thing. If they have too much money and power, what happens? You get the 60s and the 70s. You get people protesting in the streets. You get women
yeah.
and gays
no.
and minorities demanding rights. Oh my God, we can't have that.
They're getting neat. They're getting greedy in the hierarchy's mind. They're getting greedy. And they're demanding too much, so we got to change this.
Right, yeah,
and
absolutely.
Boy, did they ever. I work in a very middle-class neighborhood, middle to lower-class neighborhood, and when I walk my dog at night, you can hear when the economy gets bad because the cars pile up on the streets because they can't afford to fix them. You can hear arguments in these little houses. You can see families fall apart. These are people that just want to work. They don't expect any fame. They don't expect anything but a nice little life. And everything in my neighborhood has completely fallen apart.
Yeah. The American dream is not to become a billionaire. The American dream, although Ronald Reagan tried very well to recalibrate it and to put, you know, it's real interesting to put Bill Gates in that spot. It's real interesting. If you look at Scholastic, what's the magazine that kids get in school? I want to say American Scholastic. It's not a Scholastic.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know what I'm talking about. They do a survey every year where they ask, who are your heroes? And right up through the early 1980s, the majority of kids always consistently said people like Abraham Lincoln, George Washington, John Kennedy. They named political leaders and political figures. Starting in the mid-1980s, they began naming people like Michael Milken and Bill Gates.
Perfect.
And that's the paradigm shift that has happened in this country, and it's a real tragedy. It's a real
greed
tragedy.
Is good. Greed
yeah,
is good.
That was the mantra. Kim, thank you very much for the call.
Thanks, Tom.
And, yeah, good to hear from you. Ron in Burlington, Vermont. Hey, Ron, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I was just wondering, you know, with the stock market going down the way it is, I know at one time IBM said that they wanted to buy back a lot of stock.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering, you know, what would happen if corporations started buying their own stock back at these lower prices? Could they eventually become private and skate some more oversight?
Sure, they could, and a number of companies have done that recently. I believe that's what's. Well, I may be wong about that. I was going to give you an example, but I'm not sure, so I won't do it. But that's what the whole thing with private equity. This whole explosion of these private equity firms and taking companies private. You know, it was a big buzzword for the last couple of years. The reason why is because of Sarbanes-Oxley. Sarbanes-Oxley said that publicly traded companies have a certain threshold of disclosure that they must meet. And so companies that didn't want to do that took themselves private. And there's a large number of them that have. I don't have a list in front of me right now, and the ones that come to mind I'm not certain of, and I don't want to name a company incorrectly, but that has happened, and frankly, I would expect if the Dow drops another 1,000 points or another 5,000 points, you know, if you look at the Japanese stock market right now, it's at 18% of where it was in 1998. If our stock market was to drop to 18% from its peak, its 14,000 peak, it would be around 3,000. And if the market got around 3,000, I would expect that you'd see a lot of companies going private. So, you know, it's a very real possibility, Ron. Mark, thanks a lot for the call. Mark in Wisconsin. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I appreciate your program. Say, I just have a question, and I'm not putting the cart before the horse here, meaning that Obama wins, and it looks like he probably will, but Henry Paulson is controlling this $700 billion, so to
actually
speak.
George Bush is controlling it.
Okay,
Paulson
well, you bring up
the,
a good point.
The front guy.
So if Obama gets in, his transition team, does that mean Henry Paulson is out and there's a whole new team that comes in and controls this money, or at that time Mr. Obama will control the money? And right now, is there somebody that's managing the ledger of this $700 billion going out?
Right.
I mean, you know.
The guy managing the money going out is a 35-year-old protege of Paulson's who worked at Goldman Sachs.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I don't have his name in front of me, but that's the case. And Mike Toth, by the way, who does our audio archives, just sent me a note. The interest on the debt that we're paying this year, I said it was $300 billion. It's actually $430 billion. He looked it up on the U.S. Treasury's website. Thank you, Michael. Mark, that's what's going on. And it's this 35-year-old kid who's going to be administering this thing. And Bill Seidman, on a week ago Monday when he gave this speech in Grand Rapids, he made the point. He said if Henry Paulson has found a 35-year-old who can administer $700 billion, because this is the guy who administered $350 billion, and he said you wouldn't believe what comes out of the woodwork when you've got $350 billion and you got to pass it out. He says if Hank Paulson has found a 35-year-old who is capable of doing this, to hell with having him run the new version of the Resolution Trust Corporation. We should put him in charge of the world.
Oh, God, this doesn't sound good, but I mean, it just leaves another question.
No, but your original question about the Obama transition team, Bush signed an executive order last week, maybe it was the week before that, about that created a transition team, that created a whole rapid transition process. And I read it and I thought, okay, there's got to be a gotcha in here. And maybe there is and I missed it. You know, maybe Karl Rove wrote this and I missed it. But what it looked like to me was that it would facilitate the process of moving from a Bush administration to an Obama administration, that it would make it smoother and easier. Now, I may be wrong. I may have misread the thing. But, my guess is that if Obama is coming in, that Bush is going to have an incentive, because this is a guy who has committed crimes for which he can be prosecuted and imprisoned.
I agree.
He's going to have a huge incentive to play very, very, very nice. That if he tries to play hardball with Barack Obama, what we have seen, you saw the Clinton machine play hardball with him, and we're seeing the McCain guy and Palin play hardball with him, and he keeps a smile on his face and he whacks it right back down. And I think that if Bush tries to play hardball with him and threaten him, you prosecute me and I'll do XYZ, something like that, that Barack Obama will shove it down his throat. So I think that Bush may be trying to be nice, but it's just a guess, Mark. We're all going to have to watch it and see what happens. I don't have an instant answer. Tom in Fort Lauderdale. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Hey, Mr. Hartman, how are you doing? Nice to speak to you. I think I have the solution for all our problems, 90% of our problems with our government. Why the American people think that we allow our elected officials to allow them to receive bribes for campaign financing, and that's basically what's going on.
Yep.
We have to put a stop to that. You wonder why the people don't think that our elected officials are listening to us. Why should they? We're not paying their campaign bills.
Yeah.
And
in Maine and in Arizona, they have a large degree of public financing, and you've got average people running for political office. Here in Portland, if you can get 1,000 people to give you $5 and sign a petition, you get $100,000 from the city to run city council.
I've written a document, declarationofethics.com, and it's an attempt to try and help this problem.
Great. Well, people can check it out.
So maybe you could take a look at it.
Yeah, declarationofethics.com.
Thank you, Tom.
Bye. I agree with you. I think that's the rot at the core of the whole thing. Oddly enough, John McCain once spoke favorably of that. He's not so much anymore. And Obama has flat out acknowledged, we've got to fix this system. And he's right.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman Program at HartmanRadio.com.
Liberal with progressive views, right to PBS. Get my news, there America's on. All day long, it's time we're moving on. liberal is not a dirty word. Contrary to what you may have heard, we're gonna stand and shout out loud. We're liberal and we're proud. We lost the big one, that's a shame. Politics is the name of the game. Our message didn't get across, I guess that's why we lost. Our clock got clean, we all went down. Now's the time to get off the ground. Pick yourself up, look around, there's an awful lot to do.
And time to come up with your drinking game for the night, or Okina, or whatever it may be. It's going to be an interesting debate. And I believe I will be on Air America tonight from time to time with all the other folks commenting and pontificating, so check it out. And by the way, this weekend, Friday night at 7 o'clock, I am speaking and doing a book signing at Democratic headquarters for San Fernando Valley. DP, Democratic Party, SFV, SanFernandoValley.com is their website, DPSFV.com. That's Friday night. And then Sunday, from 2 to 4 in the afternoon, American Jewish University in Bel Air in the Gindy Auditorium. Stephanie Miller and I will be debating a couple of conservatives. It's a $25 entrance fee. Should be a great show. And there's a phone number you call to register for that. You can find that over at our website at TomHartmann.com. And here it is. It's 310-440-1246, 440-1246, 866-303-2270, our phone number, Mike in Mount Vernon, Washington. Hey, Mike, what's on your mind?
Tom, thank you for your show. I just felt compelled to call in to give a report on completely unethical campaign practices going on at all levels. Yesterday in the mail, I got this, what had to have been a very expensive mail-out, an 8.5 by 11 glossy hard cardboard sheet with a picture of my state senator, just at the local level, my state senator in my 10th congressional district, and her picture is placed right next to the Soviet Union leader Yuri Andropov, who was appointed at the same time she first entered the state senate, and I can't believe that these people would run smear campaigns. They're saying that somehow she's connected to, and Yuri Andropov has a big flag, the Russian flag on him, and it's like somehow she's connected to him. The unethical campaign practices, I just don't think we can put anything below them at this point. They will stoop so low.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And as they say in the Obama campaign ad, let me see if I've got it queued up to the right spot.
Down on Wall Street abuses. And John McCain, with no plan to fix our economy, smears are all he has left.
And that's the bottom line for the whole bunch of them. They got nothing. They got nothing but smears.
And
so,
and this is at the local state Senate level.
Yeah.
I mean, their practices, it's their standard playbook. And I just felt I had to report this. It's just terrible.
Well, thank you, Mike. Great to hear from you. And I know it's going to get worse. There's 20 days to go, 20 days to go, and some of these guys are looking at going to prison. You know, Karl Rove could go to prison for the things he's done if they can't keep Republicans in power. So they're going to do everything they can to make sure. You move on, by the way. This is a great new ad. Talk to your parents about John McCain. It's like a takeoff on the thing on drugs. You know, the kids are looking through their parents' room and they find one of these drill here, drill now things, and they go to their parents going, "What?" And here it is.
Mom, Dad, I found this in your room today.
Are you thinking about voting for John McCain?
Just because other people your age are doing it doesn't make it cool.
You say it's harmless. It's just one vote.
Voting Republican even once
can have disastrous effects that last for years.
You're not only risking your future, you're risking mine.
Mom, talk to your parents about John McCain.
For my sake, please vote for Barack Obama.
Before it's too late.
MoveOn.org. Political action is responsible for the content of this.
Etc. It's great. Oh, my. Let's see here. Sid in Detroit. Hey, Sid, what's on your mind?
Hello?
Hey, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I just want to remind my fellow Democrats in Michigan and other states that Obama is really pulling ahead. The danger of that, we experienced this a few years back for when the governor election between Blanchard and Engler was going on.
Mm-hmm.
Blanchard was leading Engler 19 points all the way to the night of election, except that November 4th was too cold and some of the inner city people didn't go and vote, and Engler won by 2 points.
Yeah.
So there is a dash of that, too. I would like to remind people, and also maybe every now and then you should remind them that don't become complacent and be happy that, okay, he's leading by double digit. We should not vote. It's very important, this
election. You're absolutely right. No matter what the polls say, get out and vote. Well said, Sid. Thank you very much. Very well said. Tony in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Tony.
Yes, hi, Tom. Hey, I was just wondering what your take is. I had heard something on the Bill Maher show that the person was saying that the Glass-Steagall Act was rescinded by Clinton, and that was part of why we're seeing the financial crisis.
It was rescinded by the Republicans in Congress as a result of a 200-and-some-odd page gotcha that was tossed in at the last minute to a Financial Services Act by Phil Graham. And, yeah, it was repealed, and Bill Clinton signed it into law, but it was Phil Graham's effort. Phil Graham, the lead economic advisor to the McCain campaign, until he said that we were a nation of whiners, and still the guy that probably John McCain would want to make Treasury Secretary. You can track, certainly the Enron thing back to Phil Graham. You can track, I think, much of this disaster back to Phil Graham. And Glass-Steagall, for people who don't know, and thanks, Tony, for bringing it up, Glass-Steagall was the law that was passed in the 1930s during the Roosevelt administration that said it's against the law for a bank to also engage in gambling, basically, in the investment business, in the brokerage business. And when that was repealed, banks got into investments, they call them, and with both feet and started trying to make some money. And the result was what you see right now in large part. Coming up tomorrow on the Tom Hartman program, Dr. Rick Scarborough will be here, founder and president of Vision America. He says that the falling Dow is the result of liberal fascism. What? And James Bamford, who has written some brilliant books about the NSA, is going to drop by. He's got a new book out, The Shadow Factory, all about NSA wiretapping in the United States. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. The whole thing begins with each one of us getting out there and getting active. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmanRadio.com.